is an informational meeting, we don't, it doesn't require a quorum. But it is the first meeting, and I had wanted to have the opportunity to have all the members introduce themselves and talk about what a wonderful time we're going to have in this committee. It has also been my intent, I forgot some first things. The Subcommittee on Human Services will now begin. And I'm Margaret Carter, your chair, and Ms. Boone, who is the representative from the House, is your vice chair. But it has been my intent to come and talk to people individually as members on this committee so that we can have a general idea of the direction in which we're going and answer any questions that you have. But I've been in meetings every minute of my life since we've been back, so forgive me for not having done that. And Senator Gordley is right up the way. I haven't even had a chance to talk to her at this point. So I know in looking at the experience and the expertise on this committee, we're going to have a good time. But I want all of you to know that this is one of the most challenging committees in this building. Simply because of the personalities, the expertise, the experience, and everything that we have. So it's going to be hard, but at the same time, challenging and exciting to be on this committee, because I do think that the issues that we will be facing and dealing with is something that I know all of you have passion about, and I think that that's really important. So why don't we start to my left and come down with members introducing themselves and telling your district.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tita Kotek, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Very excited to be here. Senator Carter is my senator from that part of Portland, and very interested in being here because of my background as an advocate on children and family issues.
Nancy Nathanson, representative from House District 13, that's North Eugene.
Bill Gerard, District 56, which is Klamath Falls, noting that I am the only male present.
We'll take good care of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Speak for yourself, Madam Chair.
All right, okay.
Susan Morgan, I represent House District 2, which is South Central Douglas County and portions of Josephine and Jackson counties.
I'm Deborah Boone, and I represent the Upper Left Coast and the other healthy fish-eating members of this state, and making sure that the I-5 corridor and South Points and Portland have a little balance brought to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Avelle Gordley, representing Northeast and Southeast Portland, and also Park Rose and Maywood Park. That's Senate District 23. I'd also like to, if I may, Madam Chair, introduce on the front row one of my students. This is Ms. Cheryl Mays, one of my students at Portland State University. She is a Black Studies major with an emphasis on psychology, has a deep interest in mental health issues, and also is observing how this process is open to the public. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome, Cheryl. Welcome to all of our participants in this issue that we call human services, because it really is something that I have seen over 9 years' time here in the legislature. See, I know Dave wanted to say something so bad I could see him laughing. I wasn't going to tell you that, because then I will be dating myself. But if there are questions that you have, we can't see everybody, but I really am impressed with the expertise on this committee, so I want you to feel free to call out members of the committee, not just the chair, because I will be listening to their concerns. Our other members will join us shortly. Today, Senator Bates had a family emergency. He had to go back to Southern Oregon. I talked with Senator Winters. She's feeling better, and she's recuperating at home. So these two people will be joining us as well. So thank you very much for the introductions. And again, I'm Margaret Carter, Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland. And I think I have the two best representatives in the state, because both of them are smart, bright, energetic, challenging, and everything else you can say about them.
I agree. Thank you, Manager.
It's wonderful. So what I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about the importance of this committee and to remind people that this committee has 25% of the statewide overall budget. And we are dealing with a very large group of human beings whose lives depend on what we do in here every day. My expectation is that members will prepare themselves and participate in conversation, not once you get here, but prior to being here, that you read materials available to you and ask pertinent questions. If you feel as if your questions are not being answered, you see our departments, you see Dr. Goldberg, and there's Mr. Psyche, there's Ramona. I mean, there's a whole troop of them right there, and I'd like for you to take advantage of talking with the department outside of committee, because do you know that we are now down to an hour and a half? So we have just a small portion of the time that we used to have in terms of working on these very pertinent issues. So that means that we would have to stay on task, and please don't get too upset with me because I moved the agenda, because we only have an hour and a half to move the agenda. And I think that I would be remiss if I would not help to direct the time and balance where we're going, because then you would feel as if we're not focusing on the goal that we have before us, and that is really, really very, very important, and that is how we can best serve Oregon citizens with the resources that we have. And so some of the things we're going to be looking at in this committee, and Representative Morgan and I have worked on this before, and that is agency performance. We've been working on this, and we'll continue that work. We'll be working on the Healthy Kids Plan, Oregon State Hospital, meaning with the community-based services and new facilities, which is a great big issue that's going to take some time for us to work through. We'll be working on TANF restructuring because that is an issue for us as we look at how the department is financed. We'll be working on child care issues for low-income families, child protective services and foster care, community supports for children and families, elderly and disabled persons. In any of your communities where there is field work and you have any questions or some concerns or you experience problems, I know Clyde is there as your deputy, but Ramona, will you stand? Ramona comes to your community. She works through things with the community and the people that you serve. And I have to tell you, I don't know of any better person that you can call upon when you have issues in your community like that. So thank you, Ramona, very much. So with that in mind, are there any questions of me before I ask Ms. Baker to take over? Ms. Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the...
Oh, one other thing. Please take this time to turn your cell phones off. I'm giving you some time. Take this time. Double check your cell phones. See if they're off. Because if they go off, you know, if they go off.
You're donating money to the children.
Children's Trust Fund.
And members, we're going to be looking at the big picture today, and so you can wait until the end of each presentation to ask questions. We have just introduced ourselves, and I'd like the last two members to introduce themselves and tell them what district you come from. Thank you.
Senator Ben Westland, District 27, Central Oregon.
Senator Bill Morissette, District 6, Lynn in Lane County.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm just going to briefly cover some nuts and bolts of the subcommittee operation. Some of this material you may have seen already in full committee, but I did want to cover it in the subcommittee as well. You should have a packet in front of you with a paper clip on it that has some information, and then there's a spreadsheet, which I'll refer to in a minute, that has some budget numbers on it. So starting with the the information on the top of your packet, informational and procedural issues. Senator Carter talked about being in attendance. We did want to note if for some reason you can't make it, please call our scheduling clerk in our office. That person will relay the information to me. I will relay it to the chair so that we are aware if you will be here or not. And this becomes particularly important as we get into the areas of work sessions and need to have quorums to move items. The subcommittee will use the Joint Committee on Ways and Means rules because it is a subset of that committee, and those rules have been adopted. Just to highlight a couple areas of that, there are no minority reports in the subcommittee, and the subcommittees cannot table items. They have to pass bills out that are assigned to them. So that is something that the subcommittee will be working on. This particular subcommittee has 5 voting Senate members and 5 House members, all of whom are voting. So we need 3 voting Senate members and 3 House members as a quorum, and then to actually act on legislation or approve budget notes or those kinds of things. The House and Senate Ways and Means co-chairs may also participate in the committee and vote when they're in attendance. That's also true of the vice chairs, but since we have the vice chairs on the committee already, they would not be available as an extra vote. Meeting operations, this notes what the chair said earlier about turning off cell phones, pagers, other electronic devices. That applies to everyone, both audience, staff, presenters, and subcommittee members. The microphones in this particular room are very sensitive. They can pick up side conversations, so you should remain aware of that. Most of the votes in the subcommittee will be done on a voice vote only. We don't traditionally or don't usually do a roll call. If a roll call is needed because there's some doubt about the vote, then the LFO analyst that's in staffing that meeting will do the roll call vote. As the chair noted, the meeting time this session is only an hour and a half, and another subcommittee meets in this room at 3 o'clock. So to give staff time to switch over for the next committee, we'll all need to vacate the hearing room as soon as possible after our subcommittee meetings end. As far as agendas, 72 hours meeting notice is required before the first public hearing on a bill, and for subsequent hearings and work sessions, we'll provide a 48 hours notice at least. This becomes changeable later in session when the House or the Senate change their rules, but at this point it's 72 hours before the first public hearing. However, bills can be carried over the next day if work is not completed on a particular bill, but it can only be carried over with the chair's announcement and for the type of meeting for which it was initially noticed. So, for example, if you're working on a bill, the work is not completed, it was a public hearing, the chair can carry it over as a public hearing. It cannot be carried over as a work session if it was not originally noticed as a work session. You'll each get a copy of the weekly agenda every Friday to help you and your staff get prepared for the week to come. We will also distribute those in the subcommittee the next Monday just to make sure you have those, and you will, of course, get a daily agenda at the subcommittee meetings each day. In the packet, there is a list of the agencies that the subcommittee will deal with and some of the significant program areas within those agencies. With the legislative fiscal office analyst and the budget and management division analyst noted on there, and the phone numbers for all those analysts are provided. As we go through the agency budgets, if you have questions on those, certainly you can contact the agency, our office, or if it's a question on in terms of the governor's budget, the budget and management division analyst is a resource for you as well. So at this time, Madam Chair, with your agreement, I'd like to have the budget and management staff stand up so that they can introduce themselves to the subcommittee, so you'll be able to know who you're working with.
Please do
there.
So.
Madam Chairman,
My name is Eric Moore. I have the Office of Private Health Partnerships, the Psychiatric Securities Review Board, the Human Services, Health Services, and Children and Family Portions of DHS.
Well, my name is Blake Johnson. I am the other part of DHS, which is SPD, the Seniors and People with Disabilities, and the Department of Life Support Services, and also long-term care on this.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Erica Steiner. I have the Board of Nursing and Life.
And I'm Jim Carboni with the Commission on Children and Families.
Thank you. And there's one other member that's not here. Sean Range has the
Board of Medical
Examiners.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm assuming that you are more familiar with our legislative fiscal office staff. The person you will probably see and hear the most is John Britton, who's at the end of the dais there, who has much of the Department of Human Services budget. I have the other pieces of the Human Services budget, as well as Commission on Children and Families. And then Deborah Manthe and Tim Walker of our office as well will be staffing this committee at various points during the session. I wanted to note that the co-chairs have developed a three-tiered process to try to expedite completion of some agency budgets. However, none of those expedited budgets are in this subcommittee, at least at this point. So I won't spend a lot of time going through that expedited process and the pros and cons and how it's differently treated. I will just note that we do expect to deal with the Board of Medical Examiners and the Board of Nursing early on. So in some ways, it's an expedited process, but it's not one within the construct that the co-chairs are using for expedited budgets. On the top of the second page of this handout, there is a list of the tentative order of budget hearings that we will be using in the subcommittee. This, of course, is subject to change as the subcommittee moves through its work, but that will give you a sense in terms of if you're reading ahead of available materials, it will give you a sense of where to focus at a particular point in time. In terms of resources, written resources, you, of course, have this lovely document, which I like to plug at every opportunity, the Legislative Fiscal Office detailed analysis of the governor's budget, and then the governor's budget document for each agency will be delivered to your offices as soon as that's available. As we talked about in the full ways and means overviews, those are done by the agencies as they reconcile their governor's budget to their agency request. So as those are available, those will be delivered to your offices. You will receive a copy of the agency's budget bill when we get into the budget hearings, and the agencies will also hand out presentation materials for members. Now, in what I see as a significant change from last session, because of the additional numbers of members on each subcommittee, we won't be able to house those binders in the committee room during the session. So your staff will need to be responsible for making those binders available. If you want the agency budget binder down here during the subcommittee meetings, then you or your staff will be responsible for bringing them and taking them back. Same thing with the presentation materials. I would encourage you to bring the presentation materials that we're working from. The agency budget binders usually are more of a backup document, and we don't usually refer to them during the budget hearings themselves. During the agency budget hearings, there will be discussion of performance measures, the agency's prioritized program list, and the 10% budget reduction options. I've attached the agency presentation guidelines. If you have questions about what agencies were supposed to be doing as they go through the budget hearings, there is variability among agencies. Not everybody will follow that outline specifically in that order or with the same level of information. So there is wide variability among agencies, but the major focus areas are outlined there for you. There will be time scheduled for public testimony for each agency, and the work sessions may follow the hearings very soon after the hearing or sometime later, depending on the issues in the agency and the budget alternatives that the subcommittee may want to consider.
I did want to talk a little bit about the Ways and Means Co-Chair's 2% reprioritization effort. Rolls off the tongue really nicely. What this is that the co-chairs have established subcommittee targets, particularly focusing on general funds, but other fund types are affected as well, to identify a 2% reduction from agency's essential budget level, but not necessarily agency by agency. So what I've tried to do in this spreadsheet that I've handed out, it shows budget history for the agencies that the subcommittee will be dealing with. But on the right-hand side of that, in the shaded area, I've illustrated if the subcommittee took a 2% reduction proportionately in general and other funds for each agency, what the magnitude of that would be. There is no requirement for the co-chairs that the subcommittee take a 2% reduction proportionately from each agency, but this just illustrates again what the magnitude of that would be. The co-chairs have indicated that half of that 2%, 1%, would be available for the subcommittee for reprioritization within the agencies that the subcommittee is dealing with, and 1% would be available to the co-chairs for reprioritization of the budget overall. So we can talk more about that when we get into the work session, but that is an issue that as we go through these agency budgets, we will be trying to identify options and what the impact of those would be. Those of you that are veterans know that after the agency hearings comes work sessions. We're planning on those this time again. That is where the actual decision-making and the changes in the numbers happen. This time through, we'll be also focusing on performance measures, the prioritized program list, as well as the budget issues. We will give you a summary memo based on discussions that had happened during the budget hearings of what the budget issues are and what our recommendations are, and various work session forums that we'll be dealing with. I didn't want to go through those in detail today, but suffice to say we will give you that information in advance of the work session meetings and walk you through the decisions and discussions during the work session. Then based on your actions there, we work with legislative counsel to make amendments to the budget bill. That then gets forwarded to the full Committee on Ways and Means together with a budget report, which is drafted by the budget management staff and reviewed by our office. And the budget report and the amendments document the recommended actions that the subcommittee has for those particular budgets. There is a bullet on budget notes. Budget notes can be included in the budget report, but they have to be pertinent to the budget, not to general policy for the agency. And the process is that generally any proposed budget notes would come through the subcommittee chair and then be approved by the co-chairs and before they are acted on by the subcommittee. At the work session, the subcommittee chair will assign members to carry the bills to the full Committee on Ways and Means and then each the House and Senate chamber. We prepare, LFO staff prepares a copy of the budget bill and the issues and actions on that for the carriers, and then we're available at the side aisle, or some members like to have us sit at their desk, to provide support if there are questions during floor discussion. So that's a short summary of the process. Again, the veterans know that, new people, hopefully that was helpful for you. Just wanted to note other things the subcommittee will be working on, as well as the assigned budget bills. There are related fee bills in Board of Nursing and Department of Human Services. We expect there will be a rebalance plan for the Department of Human Services 2005-07 budget. So their current biennium budget to be rebalanced during session is done as a budget bill, and it goes through the process similar to any other budget bill. There will be federal grant applications requests throughout the session that will come before the subcommittee. Agency reports, either as part of an agency budget hearing or separately, depending on timing, reports that were perhaps requested by the last legislature or by the interim emergency board. And then, of course, substantive legislation that has a fiscal impact as assigned by the co-chairs. So those are things that we will be scheduling during the session in and around all the budget bills that we will be hearing as well.
Any questions of Ms. Baker?
So we want to call the department, Dr. Goldberg, and we want to facilitate who's going to come with you.
But for a moment, they were going to leave me alone. For the record, my name is Bruce Goldberg. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services, and joining me today are John Swanson, our budget director, and Jim Scherzinger, chief financial officer. And we're going to provide you with a very brief high-level overview of the department, and then we're going to have each of our division directors provide you with a brief high-level overview of the programs that we do and the people that we serve. That's going to take place over the rest of the session today, as well as tomorrow for another hour and a half. I'm really happy to be here today on the first day of the Ways and Means process. Our mission as DHS, I think as you see, is to assist people to become independent, healthy, and safe. We, through our programs and services, actually serve everybody in the state of Oregon through things like being certain that people have safe drinking water and assuring that disease outbreaks and infections are controlled. We provide services to every single person in the state. We also provide direct services to over 1 million people in the state of Oregon. That's almost a third of the population rely on us for a direct service. And we do some of the most important work that government does. We provide vital support to some of our most vulnerable citizens, many of whom are unable to care for themselves. We help those with mental illness get the care that they need. We help those individuals with developmental disabilities get dignified and appropriate care. We assist our seniors get the services that they, and as my kids remind me every day, that we all will need as we age. And we help those who need basic health care get basic health care. The list goes on and on and on. And we don't do this work alone. We work with a variety of community partners. In fact, as you see, most of our budget is actually spent out in the community working with our partners who provide these services. And hopefully as we go through the next several months through the Ways and Means process, you'll get a really good picture of the people we serve as well as the people that we work with to provide those services. I hope you'll also get a good sense of the human services needs in our communities, because this really isn't, as I always like to remind everybody in our organization, this isn't a budget and a financial exercise. This is really about people. And we have large human services needs in our communities, many of which we unfortunately are unable to meet. And we know many of those. You know the individuals in our state who don't have access to basic health care. You know the individuals in our state with mental illness who don't get the care that they need. You know that there are still many children and families in this state that are hungry. And because of that, I think it's really incumbent upon all of us to be as efficient and effective in the work that we do. My goal as the director of the department, and as I'm sure yours is to have an Oregon where our most vulnerable citizens are able to live healthy and independent and safe lives. And to do that, I think we're going to need investments in human services. I want our agency to be an agency that you and the people of Oregon are proud of and that you want to make investments in. Because by doing so, you'll be confident that the return on that investment is going to be large. That you'll know that by investing in us, your dollars are going to be well spent, that we're going to provide excellent services, and that people in the state are going to get the myriad of needs met that they require. So, you know, how do we organize such a huge enterprise like this to do that? And you'll see our organizational chart on the page in front of you. You can see that we're in essence organized into six divisions based on five programmatic areas, and we have a shared division of administrative services. And that's done specifically, which you'll hear about, to be able to efficiently pool many of the administrative services, such as human resources and contracting, and many of the services that are common to all the kinds of programs that we provide. But to me, the most important thing is that when you look at what the human services needs are in our state, it really doesn't mirror the organizational chart, because what we know is that there are families in which, living in the same household, we have children who get services through our health plan, and they have seniors living in those same households who are reliant on us for services. There are individuals who have mental illness and who need food stamps and who have children. And all of what we do is really interrelated. And what our challenge is to deliver those services in a way that's integrated and seamless and really makes the divisions that you see on this piece of paper disappear. We employ over 9,000 staff in the 07-09 governor's budget. It's 10,111 positions, 9,700 roughly full-time equivalent positions. We have over 250 programs that we run out of our organization. And once again, it's not uncommon that many individuals will get services from multitudes of those programs, because that's what it takes to make our communities healthy and safe. And we have approximately 500 funding sources. And it's actually organizing and maintaining accountability for those funding sources, which I think all of you know has been a challenge for the agency. One of the issues that we've been dealing with over the last year has been assuring that we have the appropriate accountability for our finances, and we've actually gotten help from many of the people on the dais today. I particularly want to point out Senator Carter and Representative Morgan, who have been working really closely with us over the last year in terms of helping to oversee our efforts at improving our financial accountability. And we've made, I think, some major steps from where we were a year ago, when I was before any board needing to explain a $136 million shortfall in our budget, to now, I believe, an agency that's able to provide the kind of accountability that people in the state are entitled to. We've made a number of changes to assure the transparency and accountability that's necessary to provide adequate human services. We've realigned our whole financial operation, have hired a Chief Financial Officer, have reorganized our structure so that there's now a Deputy Director for Operations and a Deputy Director for Finance, Jim Scherzinger, who we've been thrilled to have as our Chief Financial Officer. We've had a comprehensive fiscal review of the agency from external sources, and out of that has come really a comprehensive plan for moving us forward towards greater fiscal accountability. And we've had an oversight committee at which Senator Carter and Representative Morgan, as well as representatives from LFO, have been a part of. It's been a really, I think, a tremendous effort to restore needed confidence, and I think we're doing a great job in that regard. But you'll let us know as we kind of go forward over the next few months.
And we think that you have done a good job. Well, I think you've done a good job.
We've also needed to ensure, and one of the issues that you'll see is that, as I indicated, although we're talking about a budget, that budget is based on people, and it's based on people's needs. And one of the issues that I'm hoping we'll have opportunities throughout the next several months to spend some time on is caseload forecasting, because certainly our ability to predict human services needs in our state out over the next 2 years is really, our ability to do that accurately is going to directly impact your ability to budget for our agency accurately. So we've been spending a lot of time on improving our caseload forecasting. And just the last comments I'll make before turning it over to Jim at a high level in terms of some of the issues that we're working on is that, to me, the future is really about how we enhance our ability to deliver services, how we improve the processes in our organization so that we deliver care in better ways. We certainly know that the way we deliver services today is different than they were 20 years ago, and it's going to be different 20 years from now. And we need to begin to prepare ourselves for that. We need to make ourselves available of the kinds of new technology and new methods for doing what we do. We need to be able to better organize our services around our clients and our communities and not organize them around our programs. And that's a key issue. And then the last theme is one that I know that the co-chairs have adopted, which is beginning to spend a better time looking at what we do in terms of the outcomes that we get. It's not the number of dollars, it's not the number of people, it's the outcomes that we get for the work that we do. And that's something that we'll be working towards and look forward to working on you with. So with that as sort of a high-level introduction, what I'd like to do is turn things over to Jim for a moment to make a couple of comments, and then John Swanson will just give you the sort of 50,000-foot view of our budget before we sort of go systematically as an overview through all of our programs.
Are there questions of Dr. Goldberg? Any questions? I want you guys to know that the gentleman that is about to speak next is a trusted and well-familiarized face with education, because he used to be our revenue officer, the former revenue officer, and then he came to Portland Public Schools and worked looking at finances there in education as well. So I want to not only welcome you, but I'm really, really glad to see you working in the department to help progress the issues of finance that some of us have been concerned about over the years.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Jim Scherzinger, Deputy for Finance, Department of Human Services. I came to the department about 8 months ago, and when I came, John was just made newly appointed as acting budget director, and now has been appointed as budget director just recently. He has been really instrumental in helping create a more transparent budget process for the department. I think that's the first step in accountability, is making a budget as transparent as you can get it. Your own staff, the DAS staff, and some other staff around the state also helped in that effort, but really John and his staff have done the work to make it happen, and so I wanted to thank him for that and recognize his staff as well. as part of that transparency process over this session, John will be here most of the time, but we will also have the budget manager for each of the, and this is, I think, different from last time, the budget manager from each division that works for each, that works with each division out of John's staff, to be there when that budget is considered. And as I said, our goal, and it's always been my goal in government, is to make things as clear as they can be so that policymakers can make the best decision they can make based on the best information they can get. And that's our goal. I will be here as often as I can be. Bruce will be in and out. You are encouraged to talk to either one of us. If you have any questions or problems come up or any advice that we could use, please feel free to do that. I'm going to be spending a lot of my time working on the sort of process improvement process that Bruce talked about and that many of you helped us with. The consultants that we brought in got here on Monday. They're now doing a whole series of interviews. And we know that this is during the legislative session, but we also know that it's important to get our processes as efficient as they can be as soon as we can. And we've talked a lot to our staff about this, and I hope you don't see any effects of it in here. That's not our intent, but I do want you to know that they're also working hard at reforming processes at the same time that they're over here helping you. And I'll be glad to answer any questions about that at any time that you have as well. So right now I think I'll just introduce John, and he's going to go through some charts.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Swanson. I'm the Administrator of the Finance and Policy Analysis Unit of the Department.
Budget Development Unit.
And we're here really to talk about programs, but I wanted to give you a real quick high-level look. And actually starting on page 4 of the presentation, there's a series of 6 graphs that will be a similar array in each of the divisions as you look at them, but they're there primarily in divisions as reference material because we're going to focus on the program overviews. The first graph just is a summary of the entire budget for the department, about a $12 billion budget, 27% of that, 27.5% in state general fund, and almost 60% in all the different kinds of federal funding that we receive. And then we also have an array of other funds that we use within our programs. What I want to do is basically the next series of graphs look at the sources, the major sources of our revenues, and then the major uses or where those resources are distributed. On page 5 at the top, you can see that our largest federal fund source is Medicaid, Title 19. We also receive temporary assistance, needy family funding, food stamps, and an array of other kinds of federal funds. One of the main points I wanted to make in looking at this is that the majority of the federal funds that we do receive are relied upon or contingent upon state investment in the programs that they fund. These federal funds are received either as a match program, where we receive at least a dollar for dollar or more from the federal government for each dollar we spend in those program areas, or on a maintenance of effort situation where a certain level of state funding is required to continue to receive the related federal funding. Approximately 86% of the state general fund in the DHS budget is used to match or leverage these federal funds, and I want to just make sure that that was heard today. You can see on the next pie chart some of the larger other fund sources, tobacco tax, and then a proposed new tobacco tax within the department, primarily in health service programs, some provider taxes, and some certificate of participation funding for some projects that we have going. The next two pie charts show how the budget is distributed between the different divisions that you'll be hearing from. First, in terms of our general fund by division, and then at the lower one, in terms of our total fund by division. And again, each of those divisions will have a similar array of some information, high level still, as to where those dollars are spent within their programs. The last slide demonstrates what Bruce had mentioned in terms of where our expenditures go, and it's the other key point I wanted to make here is that the vast majority of the expenditures for the department are directly to clients for benefits and services through our programs. About 4% of our budget is comprised of the Centralized Administrative Services Division. About 7.5% of the budget is for field service to serve our clients in the field and manage those. About 2.5% for our state-operated services, and then about 1.6% for population-based services, which are services to the population in general, not to specific client or specific caseloads. And that's primarily our services that public health provides.
Just one question. As I was looking at the seniors and disabilities, is long-term care in that area? Because it's pretty shocking to look at the growth in senior and seniors and people with disabilities when you compare that to the Division of Medical Assistance programs and those things that are in that.
Correct. Yes, it is where long-term care is, the seniors and people with disabilities.
And so that's our fastest growing area, would you say?
It is. I don't know if it's our fastest, but it is a fast-growing area.
It's certainly one that you'll hear from James Tays, I believe, tomorrow, who will talk to you about the demographics of our state, the aging demographics, and the fact that, indeed, that's an issue, a great issue of concern, I think, for all of us, is how we will continue to provide the services as we live longer and have greater needs. With that, Madam Chair, we're ready to step down if you'd so like and start to walk through each division.
Is that? Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director at DHS in an area called Children, Adults, and Families. And generally, when we say that name, people wonder what else there is, if everything is not Children, Adults, and Families. The programs in our division are based really on a simple premise, and that premise is that most individuals, most families, want to be self-sufficient financially. They want to be self-sufficient emotionally. They want to be able to take care of members of their own family and protect their family's needs. But for many of the citizens here in Oregon, that is really a challenge for many of those individuals because of problems associated with mental and physical disabilities, unemployment, alcohol and drug addiction, and histories of domestic violence or child abuse. So the Children, Adults, and Families, or the CAF, as we call it, CAF Division, provides support to these families in order to ensure stability, both financial stability for the family as well as emotional stability for the family. And you see in our document a list of the services or the kinds of things that families might come to us seeking: cash assistance, medical assistance, food stamps, case management, job assistance, child care, and child safety and protection. Most of that list, until you get to child safety, most of those are what we call voluntary services. Families self-identify they have a need, and they come forward and they apply. They seek eligibility for a particular service. The situation with child safety and protection, often it's less voluntary and more involuntary, because those are going to be the services that are attached to a case where we get a report of abuse or neglect and there's some need in the family that we need to respond to. As you all know from your constituents, this is the most emotional area, possibly, of almost any of our services, because rarely do we have all parties happy in a situation where we have child safety issues that are pending. Without these kinds of services, what happens is families and individuals often will require more extensive service and more intrusive services. And the example we gave here is how assisting a parent to become clean and sober can give a much better outcome for a family than having to remove the children and place the children in foster care for safety purposes. So it's kind of where we want to invest. It's trying to invest in the front end of systems so that we're not always paying at the back end of those systems because of the lack of those services to help families. You'll see there some data about how many people we served during 2006. About half a million of these are low-income Oregonians. 14% of the total population received food stamps, cash assistance, and or medical assistance, some combination or either one or the other service. 38,700 individuals received child welfare services, and then 17,800 individuals with disabilities received assistance in preparing for employment. In the self-sufficiency areas, so three big areas in CAP, self-sufficiency, vocational rehabilitation, and child welfare. In self-sufficiency, the purpose there is to provide assistance for low-income families to help them become self-supporting. And when we go to the next phase of our presentation, you'll be hearing details about temporary assistance to needy families, the TANF program, food benefits, child care, refugee assistance, and medical eligibility, which is done out of CAF. In the vocational rehabilitation area, many of you are familiar with the fact that this is where we assess, plan, develop, and provide rehab services to individuals who have disabilities but who are eager to get into the job market. And there are several components of that particular service. The basic services, youth transition program, supported employment services, and independent living. And you'll have details on those presented to this committee. In child welfare, these are children that are considered dependent children, 0 to 18. And generally these children that we're going to be serving are neglected, abused. They may have disabilities, or they have been placed in the legal custody by a court for some reason as attached to the law. And these particular services include child protection, out-of-home care, which includes foster family care, and adoptions. Our delivery system, we have about 4,500 staff in the department, and we have over 100 field offices that do the self-sufficiency and child welfare services. And then Voc Rehab has their services through 34 offices in the state. We divide into 16 districts, and we have a processing center here in Salem that does OHP, Oregon Health Plan, standard eligibility, as well as some of the other OHP eligibility programs. And also, to deliver services, we use something called the EBT, Electronic Benefits Transfer Card, and that includes TANF and food stamps for individuals who receive those services in the state. On our outcomes, when you look at self-sufficiency programs, we had about 434,000 persons who were able to receive additional help around nutrition through the food stamp program in our state. In addition, we had 18,000 Oregon families receiving cash assistance for basic living expenses through the TANF program. Of those 18,000 families, 11,000 individuals were looking for employment or training services. And if you wonder what happened to the other 7,000, those are going to be a category we will talk about in some detail. Those are non-needy relatives, where the relative isn't receiving assistance, the adult relative, but they're caring for children who are eligible for TANF benefits. Employment-related daycare is another area that we have responsibility for, and this is helping to serve 9,500 low-income working families. Generally, that accounts for about 20,000 children, with a little more than two children per family. In vocational rehabilitation, you see the number there, 17,779 individuals who were assisted, and of those, 2,984 Oregonians secured competitive employment, which enabled them to move forward and receive either less benefits or no benefits from the state, and 261 youth who were served through the Youth Transition Program, an important program for youth who have disabilities and who want to move on to higher education or to some kind of competitive employment. In child welfare, protective service assessments were completed for 19,373 families. And then an important piece that I think sometimes we need to remind ourselves, for those children who came into foster care or were living in foster care, 64% of the children left foster care to be reunited with their families. And that's always something we want to pay a lot of attention to, because that's usually our first goal with children coming into foster care, is to see if those children can safely be returned to their families. And we also did finalize adoptions. for 1,033 children who had been residing in foster care, and this was a 9.5% increase over the previous year of 2004. There's a little history there of our programs. I would just make that a short history for you and say many of you know the TANF program was originally aid to families with dependent children. That was the original program back from, I think it started in the 30s. And the focus of that program was really to keep families together. So you'd have mainly a mom and her children, and they would receive an entitlement. But there wasn't a lot of energy around what's going to happen ultimately. And the sad thing about that program was many of those moms would become displaced homemakers when their children finished high school and they were no longer eligible for assistance. So the TANF program is really geared toward making sure people have opportunities to get into the job force, any adults in a household that might be eligible, and teenagers in the household who may be finishing school and need those same kinds of opportunities. So that was a significant shift in the purpose of those programs. Also, vocational rehabilitation, the legislation supporting that program is 85 years old. There have been some changes, and it is up for reauthorization this next year. But most of the focus, again, has been on making people eligible and available for the kinds of jobs that exist. That's been a real shift, of course, as technology has changed many of what those jobs look like. And in child welfare, two pieces of legislation I call your attention to. One was Oregon's Best Interest of the Child legislation, which was SB 689. That was several years ago. That was prior to my time here in Oregon, but it certainly laid the groundwork for paying attention to the fact that it's not okay to take children into foster care and leave them just sitting in foster care. That was followed by the federal law, Adoption and Safe Families Act, ASFA, and many of you all have heard of ASFA, because it actually prescribes time frames on how long children can stay in foster care prior to there being a consideration of another plan being put in place. Two major changes, there have been lots of changes in this biennium, but two major changes. One is the reauthorization of the TANF program, which was part of the Deficit Reduction Act, passed in February 2006. That's when it was reauthorized, and Senator Carter has already made mention of the fact that this will take a lot of energy this session to see what Oregon wants to have as its public policy around this TANF reauthorization. Some of the changes in that are there changes in the participation rates, the percentage of folks that have to be in jobs, how we define what jobs are or how we define work, documentation of that work, and also time limits. We no longer have our waiver, and so we have to pay attention to time limits for a number of the families receiving TANF benefits. And the other you probably heard about was a big change that also came out of the Deficit Reduction Act, and that was Medicaid citizenship documentation, making sure that folks that are receiving Medicaid are eligible and that documentation is part of the record. And in talking with staff, we believe we have overcome quite a hurdle in terms of getting that done. We still continue to help people and work with folks to make sure they have the documentation. But it was a difficult course, and we've come through that. And so we think we have a pretty good way of working on that now. In terms of performance measures, we have of the 29 key performance measures, five of those relate to self-sufficiency, one with voc rehab, and two within child welfare. And you will see on there the first one, key performance measure number five, the percent of temporary assistance to needy families, adults placed for whom, whom employment is a goal. The goal was to be 11.1% of adults entering employment. In 2005, our actual performance is 8.3% entering. And several things will influence how successful we are. One is the availability of jobs, what's out there in terms of the job market for people who need to have those jobs. Second is the preparation for the applicant. How well are we doing in preparing applicants to be successful into getting into jobs and staying in jobs? And then third is the consideration that those folks that remain on TANF will be more difficult to get into jobs, quite likely, because they have more than one problem, perhaps. We may have a mom who is mentally ill but also has alcohol and drug problems. So all of those will influence that particular measure. But we will talk about those measures in detail when we talk about the programs themselves.
Ramon, would you put this on your reporting back on that, too? Let me know the status of especially the status of men and how you're helping them with job opportunity, but especially as I look at the largest group of unemployed men in our state, African American, Hispanic males. And so I'd like to let me know, for you to let us know how you're doing in that area.
Chair Carter would be pleased to do that. Thank you.
Senator Morissette, please.
Thank you. I attended a conference recently that dealt with TANF and NCSL, and they were talking about the changes and so on and the various maintenance of effort possibilities. Are we going to be looking at the different maintenance of efforts? This may be a dumb question. Do we have a list of the maintenance of efforts? Could you get me and I give me that list?
Chair Carter and Senator Morissette, that is very much on our radar. And we're working with, in fact, Sheila Baker and others looking at how that maintenance of efforts is being done, what the implications are with the changes in TANF, and how the best way is for the state to go forward.
Okay, so that is coming soon.
Yes, it is.
Okay, good, good.
Second measure is the percent of TANF clients who do not return or are off of cash assistance 18 months after exiting TANF due to employment. The goal for that measure was 92%, and we achieved 91.4%, meaning those individuals were not on TANF 18 months later. My caution about this one is this is not a measure of success necessarily. It simply is a measure of who is not back on TANF. If individuals end up having more serious outcomes, for example, being incarcerated or needing to have institutionalization for mental health issues and so forth, those individuals would not show back up on TANF. And so it's a cautionary measure. Also, if a parent loses their children to foster care and they're no longer eligible for TANF. So we want to be cautious when we look at that measure and know that we don't actually have the authority to follow every person who was on TANF to see what's happened to them 18 months later. Measure number 7 is the pregnancy rate per 1,000 females ages 15 to 17, and as you can see, Oregon is doing very well on that one. In fact, so well that we are actually working with the Progress Board. Again, I would say that I was feeling really good about that. We looked at the national figures, and nationally, the nation has done a much better job around this particular measure. So we take that into consideration as we look at what that new target should be. Number 8, the percentage of child care providers who are providing enhanced quality of care. In December, the program had achieved 25.2% versus the goal of 27%. And you will have a lot of information presented to you on this issue of child care because it is a problem in our state. We don't have a very high pay rate for individuals providing child care, and therefore a number of the individuals choose to use family members for child care, which does not then provide them the subsidy they would have if they were being licensed through the employment department. So there will be quite a bit of attention, especially as we look. This is associated also with TANF and what's going to happen with TANF. We have to know how children will be well cared for and how those children will be developed so that they're ready to start first grade. The number 10 is the ratio of Oregonians receiving food benefits compared to the estimated number of Oregonians living at or below the poverty level. And Oregon is doing a much better job than many states in terms of making sure folks are receiving food stamps, people who are eligible. We've also improved greatly our accuracy rate around eligibility. But I know I saw Patty Whitney Wise here in the audience, and I think I have to give her a lot of credit because our partners have really helped Oregon and helped the agency move towards making sure that we are stellar, really, in the nation and making sure that the folks who actually qualify for food stamps are getting those. Many states have not made that a priority, I would say. In vocational rehabilitation, the percentage of the voc rehab consumers with a goal of employment who obtained employment. Our goal for this measure was 66%, and in 05, our actual performance is 63.4%. Again, we didn't quite make that mark. We will talk some more about what the implications of that are, what kind of jobs are available, how are we making sure that voc rehab consumers have the right sets of skills that it will take to get into those jobs and be successful. And then two measures in child welfare, the median number of months from the date of last removal from the home to a finalized adoption. You will see that we actually did meet that. In Oregon, the goal was 33.3 months, and we had, the reality was 33.3 months compared to 32.1 months in 2006, so we actually have made improvement on that. We would like to see more improvement for those children for whom adoption is the plan. We would like to see that number be much less, but we will report to you on that And then number 14, the percentage of abused and neglected children who are re-abused within 6 months of prior victimization. Our re-abuse rate is 6.7%. We have to be below 6.1% to meet the federal standard. But in 05, we had had a re-abuse rate of 10.2%. So we are moving in the right direction. So we feel good about that. We'll talk with you in more detail. Just briefly, the outstanding issues that you see. Drug abuse continues to be a huge factor influencing all of our programs in CAF. Approximately 62% of the children who came into foster care during 2005 had parental drug abuse as a reason for placement. And we don't track which drugs are being used by those families, but we do know that it's estimated that approximately 47% of all the children entering foster care were entering at least in part because of parental methamphetamine use. I've already mentioned the TANF as a large issue for us, the reauthorization and the choices that the state has to make as public policy as we go forward. Affordable child care, I have mentioned. Vocational rehabilitation, again, they're facing reauthorization in that program nationally, and there's a special emphasis being placed on transition-aged youth. Child welfare, we've had two major reports done by national experts. They give us a lot of good advice, good suggestions on how to move forward. And two of those things, one has to do with supervisor-to-worker ratio and how we will address that as a state, and the other has to do with caseload size. How many cases can a worker reasonably carry if the worker is going to be successful? All of those things will be before us for discussion before you all during this session. And I think we have some valuable information to share with you when we go to those details. I would just say on the budget overview for the CAF, one of the things I would call to your attention, when you look at those pie charts, you will see that a lot of CAF's budget relates to federal funds. That very first chart, we have a heavy reliance on federal dollars. And that means several things that we should keep in mind. One is compliance with federal requirements is critical. We can't ignore federal requirements. And sometimes folks get very frustrated with us because we have a federal requirement. We might not like it, and there are things we can do to try to change a federal requirement, but we have to make sure we have integrity in the programs. And with Dr. Goldberg's leadership, we have been even more diligent about making sure that we are very clear in articulating who is eligible for what kinds of services. The other thing to keep in mind is this also means, because of the large federal drawing CAF programs, it makes us more vulnerable to any changes in federal direction and federal funding. If Congress decides to do certain things or do things a different way, there's usually going to be an impact for the programs that are served through CAF. And I would make those two points. I don't have particular notes to share on the other charts, but we'd be glad to answer any questions. Were you going to say anything?
Questions or remarks?
Yeah, I have a question about food stamps. Has there been any move toward, and I should preface this with, this is the area I hear a lot about in my district from constituents. People usually bring anecdotal information. They see somebody at the grocery store buying a lot of potato chips and pop or whatever, and then using food stamps to pay for it. So I get these suggestions, and I think they're valid. Is there any way that we can provide incentives and for using the food stamps, not to say they couldn't buy the other things, but they would get points for making healthier choices or something like that?
Chair Carter and Vice Chair Boone, I think we will bring that information to you when we do the details on the food stamp program. I think we do believe that that is the direction we should go in. The food stamp program is federally controlled. It's federally funded for the most part, and the eligibility and all the requirements related to it emanate from Washington, D.C. So there may be some opportunities we have, but pretty much we have to comply with all of the requirements of the federal government. They may not be quite there yet in terms of that piece, but certainly nutrition was to be the original purpose of that program.
Thank you.
Representative Nathanson?
Thank you. When you come to talk to us about vocational rehabilitation, I hope that you can provide a little information on the key performance measure number 3, which we saw on page 6, and then the goal was 66%, but how that relates to the numbers that we saw on page 3. 17,000 individuals were assisted, approximately
approximately 3,000 secured employment, and I understand that there's explanation that you can provide for those numbers.
Chair Carter and Representative Nathanson will be delighted to. Stephanie Parrish Taylor is the administrator for Voc Rehab, and she will be very prepared to answer those questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Ramona, bring me a study of affirmative action in terms of numbers of people of color that are working in the agencies and the proportionality. I'd appreciate that.
Chair Carter will be glad to do that.
One of the things I do know that that Jackson County was one of the leading counties in terms of high incidences of pregnancy. Bring us what is the leading county now, and what are the strategies we're using in terms of family planning education?
Okay, forgive me for not knowing that.
Asking you to bring it back.
We will.
Not that you should know that today.
Okay, good. Thank
not
you.
Not at all. But anything else, any questions that you have in terms of issues that you'd like for her to bring back before us? Because I don't like agencies having surprises, and so let's ask them in advance if they bring it back the next time. Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. If you could make a distinction between, I'm looking at key performance measure number 5 and the number of folks moving into employment. If you have a way of teasing out the number who move into employment that is a living wage job versus employment, that would be very helpful. That nuance would help us better understand.
Chair Carter and Senator Gordon, we will work on that.
Thank you.
Further question? Senator Morrison.
Dealing with vocational training and job opportunities, to what extent do we try to place people in jobs that have a future? In other words, rather than a dead-end job, because those are the ones that are going to come back. But to place a person in a job that they are qualified for with opportunities for advancement, I think, is a huge step forward.
Chair Carter and Senator Morissette, I think we would totally agree with that. And one of the concerns we'll talk about with the reauthorization is there will be tremendous pressure to get people into a job. And I think you're absolutely right. If it's not a job that's going to actually carry that person forward and out of poverty, it's going to be a continuing challenge for us. But we will bring some detail back on that issue.
I appreciate that a lot, because I think sometimes the legislature, and since I'm one person that has been on human services for 22 years, I've had a chance to see a really changing of the guard of the legislature, and can use the term the legislature. I think too many times we expect miracles from you when in reality you have federal guidelines, other funds guidelines, as well as state guidelines in terms of expectation. But also, with those state dollar usages, I really, really am concerned about those people that are going into the workforce, but they are partially in the workforce and partially still are receiving a subsidy. And so it appears to me that the more we can get them into family wage jobs, the more we're going to get them from being dependent upon the system. And so it would appear to me we'd be looking very strongly at family wage jobs and preparing them for beyond just entry-level positions that many times people get into.
Thank you, Chair Carr.
Further concerns or questions? Dr. Goldberg?
We have, I think, Alan Hill. Is our last piece for today. How's that?
That's great. The community loves you today. But before you get too excited.
I'll every day.
Yeah, I know. So you come forward.
For the record, my name is Alan Duman. I'm deputy director to Dr. Goldberg and also administrator for DMAP. And Chair Carter and Vice Chair Moon, I want to thank you very much for giving my first opportunity to actually testify in a legislative committee. And I want to mirror...
Don't make those darts. Don't throw it at him.
Yeah, really. Wait until next week and then you can... I want to mirror what Dr. Goldberg said. I mean, it really is critical for us to be able to provide the services that you think we should provide, and that's what we should do, is to be able to provide as much information to you that you you can that is useful, which means I don't want to inundate you with facts that just overwhelm you. At the same time, I want to be able to answer the questions that are most useful for you, which means that I need to hear your questions as much as possible. And my staff, who are watching me here on the phone or on the TV at this point, are actually anxious to be able to answer those questions. Before starting, I'd like to know, I know you were looking to complete this session at what time?
So you have approximately 13 minutes.
Okay. I will shorten my presentation. The information that you have available has already been handed out to you, and I was really going to follow through that and do some highlighting of it. And a couple of times I'll reference it, so if you could sort of keep up with me, that would be helpful. Actually, in the federal Medicaid program, there are 26, actually, instead of the 25 that it says there, eligibility categories for which feds will match us in money, and in a moment I'll talk why that's so important. But you really can roll these up into five groups or five big categories, which are children, pregnant women, adults and families with dependent children, individual disabilities, and elderly individuals. And these are sort of the mandatory categories. There are also some optional categories which we have chosen to support, and I will talk about that in a moment as well. Medicaid is a program that is based on financial need, not simply on any kind of medical need. And because of that, we do a lot of eligibility determination based on finances, and that's family finances. If you look at the bullets that are in the first page there, it gives you sort of a handle on seeing different programs have different levels of FPL, the federal poverty limit level, running from 49% all the way up to 225%. And there's a variety of reasons for that, and we can get into explanations of that further on in the session as we get more detail. The one thing that's important, if you look at foster children at 49%, that sort of glares at you. Why does that make any sense? And the reason for that is that's actually the income for the child, for the individual child. And as you can imagine, they're almost always under the 49% level. Approximately 400,000 Oregonians are covered at any one time. And the numbers, by the way, here are estimates or preliminary numbers from December. They're the latest sort of real data we have. I let you know that these numbers actually are somewhat higher when we finally get the retros, as they're called, when we get the additional people in. About 350,000 of this total group is actually under what we call the OHP Plus program. And this is compared to two other groups. There's non-OHP programs, and there's also the OHP standard. And the OHP standard is something that's been fairly unique to Oregon, and the OHP standard covers adults. And I'll talk a little bit more detail about our experience with that. DMAP is really an insurance company. And I use that term company loosely. It's an insurance organization. And we act in many ways like any other insurance organization, in that we provide insurance coverage to our members or our clients. We do not provide medical services directly. And a lot of people have a confusion about that. We do this in two ways. We do it through capitated managed care programs, and we also do it through what's called fee-for-service. In the capitated programs, we contract with other organizations in various communities, and there are 14 of those, to do deliver the service through their providers that they're contracted with in their local communities. And so we actually organize and do a lot of work in having to do with quality assurance and that kind of thing with the capitated health plans, who are our partners throughout the state in actually getting the services delivered. In addition to that, about a quarter of the people in DMAP or in DMAP programs are in our fee-for-service plan, and that fee-for-service plan is administered by DMAP directly. That's where we have a claims operation in the building down the street, and just for reference, about half of our staff, half of our budget is directed toward that fee-for-service claims operation. About 1.7 million people have been covered, their health care has been covered since the inception of the Oregon Health Plan. Part of the reason that's a huge number, but there's a significant amount of churn, people on and off over the course of a year. Nearly one-third of all Oregonians have been on the Oregon Health Plan at some point in the life of the plan. About 44% of Oregon births in 2004 were covered under our programs, and about 12% of all Oregonians are covered at any one point in time, including today. Important point to note is that 98% of our budget actually goes to the delivery of services outside of DMAP. Only the remaining 2% is actually for our administrative cost. Oregon ranks 44th in Medicaid expenditures per eligible individual. It's a great place to be, and this is a reflection of a variety of things, including benefit levels, but it's also related to the fact that our managed care organizations, as well as our own administrative management within DMAP, are able to provide these services and get good quality services at lower cost. Of all the people who are enrolled in a plan, this includes the fee-for-service and managed care, who are covering their physical health, about 76% of those are in one of these managed care plans that I talked to you about. On the dental side and the mental health side, that figure is over 90% for each of those. The impact of having health insurance is probably well known to all of you, and I don't need to go into a great deal of depth about that, its impact on the access to care, the impact of having access to care on the treatment of care, prevention of more extreme chronic diseases, which leads to higher cost care, as well as a significant amount of cost shifting that's going on with people who are not covered with any insurance. There's that cost is borne by the providers, but eventually that gets shifted to whoever else is paying, and predominantly that's the private sector, because that's where all the money is. So it's our service is also to save money for folks who are not under the public sector plans. But it's also important to know that good medical health, good mental health, extraordinarily important in productivity as well as prevention of a lot of other untoward things, including criminal activities and all the impact on our society, both with regard to cost and with regard to sense of insecurity because of that. So with all of the DHS programs, we all integrate, we all intertwine, and we all take credit for everything. But no, we all give credit to everybody because we are so interrelated. There have been some significant changes in the last biennium, just to denote a couple of those. One is that the Medicare Part D started paying, for drugs, and so there's a tremendous amount of shift, and you've read a lot about it. As much problems as there may have seemed to have been in Oregon, we actually were a model state, and a lot of that has to do simply extra hard work on the part of people in Department of Human Services long before I came. We have resubmitted our application for our waiver for the Oregon Health Plan. We sent it in last month. Our waiver will expire October 31st, 2007, and we're assuming that we will go through the normal lengthy process for CMS to approve this renewal. I think that probably the biggest thing that's occurred in the last biennium was the impact or the closing of the standard program, OHP standard, and the impact on that. And that's something that certainly will be in discussion during this biennium and during your deliberations with regard to our upcoming budget. Just to put it in perspective, several years ago, the OHP standard had over 100,000 people enrolled in it, and now we're down to 21,000. That has occurred through normal attrition, meaning that simply people go off the plan, and if they can't get back on or somebody else can't get in, then the plan goes down fairly rapidly, and we're now down at about 21,000 and looking hopefully to be able to expand that into the future. The other thing that's important to note with this program is it's presently supported by provider taxes, client pay premiums, and matching federal funds. No general funds are used for this particular program. Our performance measures that are directly attributed to DMAP are two. They're both sort of revolving around the delivery of routine care. Routine care is really primary care and prevention. We're focused on that because by providing more of that, we decrease the need for more expensive catastrophic care or even chronic care. And so this is a measure that we can make, and we look toward improving it year by year. Through some significant amount of hard work, primarily on the part of our partners, this number for adults has increased from 70.4 to 75.7, and for children has increased from 69.3 to 72.0 from 2001 to 2005, and we have surpassed our targets in both of those, and we need to renegotiate our targets higher as a result of that so we can set our sights a bit higher. The other aspect of routine care that's important is to make sure that there are not racial and ethnic disparities with regard to who is getting this kind of care. And so we measure that component as well. And if you look to see, we have bullets there. We have five different racial ethnic groups. And all five of them have had significant improvements in the 4-year period between 2001 and 2005. And the numbers are relatively close. Given a lot of the disparities one sees and things like unemployment you were talking about earlier, to see this fairly minor change in access to routine care across racial or ethnic divisions is good. It's still not perfect. We'd like to see them actually even eventually. We have other measures that are related to what other people doing, including teen suicide, prenatal care for low-income women, tobacco cessation, and immunization rates. What are the outstanding issues that we face? Well, I wish I could say that the most outstanding issue is that DMAP is so inefficient in administrating its programs that it will just save all this money and that will be the end of that. Unfortunately, that's not the case. And let me just get you to turn, by the way, to the last page. There's a pie chart there. And this is how we spend our total funds. This is in the governor's recommended budget for this coming biennium. And if you'll notice up there that DMAP administration is 1.5%. The rest of this is spent with our service providers, including our managed care organizations, in the direct delivery of care. So if we're going to be able to save money, if we're going to be able to get more outcomes with lower amounts of money expended, we obviously need to focus on that 98%. Unfortunately, in attacking that 98%, we're in the same position that every other insurance organization is in, and every other business is in, and every one of us and individuals are in. Its medical cost inflation is just staring us in the face and almost running us over. Put it in perspective, the change in the budget between last biennium and this projection for this biennium, simply for keeping up with medical cost inflation for the DMAP program, is over $500 million. We don't get anything more for that. We simply keep up with the medical inflation rate. So this is our major nut to crack. It's where we think, and one of the things attracted me to the position, by quite frankly, is Dr. Goldberg thinks that we all need to work together. All insurance programs, public and private, need to be attacking this as soon as we can and as fast as we can. Another major issue with regard to our costs are the level of unemployment. Certainly as unemployment goes up, people who are eligible because of income goes down. It's also the issue is as the costs go up for medical insurance, the willingness on the part of employers to have medical insurance available for their employees goes down. Those people then are uninsurable in that sector, and many of those people are eligible because of income for our programs. So as Dr. Goldberg already pointed to, it's really critical for us to be able to project the caseload forecast, who's eligible, who's going to be eligible, in order to have some reasonable ability to project budgets. The other thing which Ramona has already talked about has to do with what the feds do. If you turn to the first graph, it's on page 10. Basically, it's looking where's the money come from. And we, like almost all the other programs at DHS, are really dependent to a great deal on the federal funds. And if you notice there, about 60% are federal funds. Just, you know, as a, just round the numbers off, you can carry around, it's easy to remember. 20% is general fund, 20% other fund, and 60% federal fund. The federal fund, for all of the reasons Ramona indicated, is something we have to be very cautious about and monitor very carefully. At the same time, the federal fund, because it's a match with money that otherwise would go to some other state, it also is extraordinarily important for us to bring as much federal match into the state as possible, because it helps support the infrastructure for everyone else. And in fact, our federal funds at this level creates 40,000 new jobs, probably, and that works through the system is maybe worth two or three times that much. So it's not simply a funding source, it's also an economic source for us. The last thing I'd like to point us to is the other funds, because oftentimes the other funds, that's on the next page, the other funds kind of gets lost. What the heck are those? In our programs, they're extraordinarily important. They're composed of three different categories: tobacco tax, provider tax, and there are other funds. The first two you probably have heard a lot about and know what they are. The other funds include things like drug rebates, premiums, third-party payments, and leverages. That's money that goes through another organization to us, and then it goes back out so we can pay more. And so our other funds, as 20% of our funds, are as critical or more critical than you'll find in any other division or department. Sorry, I took 3 minutes too long.
Good job.
Thank you very much.
Good job. Sweet, are you the campaign manager for Governor Goldberg?
I did hear that.
Actually, I've been trying, but I don't think.
No. I had to take one dig. I couldn't let you leave without having one dig. I represented Nathanson and Benson. I represented Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question while the director is still with us. The speaker mentioned interrelationships.
Dr. Goldberg, would you join us again?
Sure. There's something that really crosses a number of agencies and departments, and I'm not sure when would be the right time to ask the question. There was a very interesting article, the $1 million, I forget the name of the gentleman. The point was that there were tremendous expenses. It was in Florida, I believe. Someone had studied this one particular case, tremendous expenses on medical assistance and other services, and the findings are that if you can stabilize the shelter or the housing situation, that many other things can fall into place more quickly. I realize we're not talking about housing today, but since we're talking about interrelationships and when you push one part of the system and don't take care of the other part, the outcomes are sometimes inappropriate. So how do we address that in Oregon?
Let me just ask a question. Would this take a little in-depth information you'd have to bring back to us?
That could be another time, certainly.
Yeah.
Like, how about we start off with a brief answer tomorrow?
Okay.
Tomorrow would be nice. Thank
great.
You.
That's
but an important question, and I think
yes,
that's exactly what we've got to address.
Mm-hmm. Mine's just a quick one, and it's the second most requested answer from my constituents. About DHS and or the health plan, and that is people who make just a few dollars too many to qualify, and then they don't get benefits at their job or from their job, or they can't afford the private coverage that's out there, so they're basically stuck without insurance coverage and for $8, $10. I mean, I hear stories of $6 too much. So what should they do? Should they ask to have a demotion in pay, which most people won't? Or is there some sort of wiggle room or some way they can actually qualify without ending up in the emergency department?
Our rules are very strict. We have to draw the line. The wiggle room is not built into the regulations, not built into the rules. Now, it's not to say that somebody couldn't wiggle themselves around that. I wouldn't counsel or give counsel on that from here. I think one of the real response to that is the understanding is there are a lot of those people who should be insured for a whole variety of reasons, not just for them, but for all of us. And there was going to be a lot of debate and discussion this session about how we do that.
Madam Chair, just a brief point of information. I represent a district that proportionately had the highest number of people on the Oregon health plans, proportionately. And so when the cuts occurred, the pain was felt deep and wide.
And I was actually not here at the time, but I felt that even down where I live, there's a lot of people. We're a lot of people in the hospitality industry where I come from in Southern Oregon, and a tremendous amount of people were right on the cusp, and they were cut as well. And it's extraordinarily negative feedback that reverberates, and that reverberation we certainly don't measure, and oftentimes we don't feel it unless we're out there just holding hands with the folks who are suffering.
Other questions? This has been a great informational sharing time, so thank you, Dr. Goldberg and staff, for your information today. We're going to have, I wrote it down, Sheila, an announcement from Sheila, and you want to give kudos.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. One is that the department will be back tomorrow to overview the rest of its operations and programs. But the other announcement was to ignore something I said earlier for once. For today, if you would leave your binders in your room, because we weren't able to get the labels on them in advance, if you leave them in the room today, we will put labels on them and they will be here for you tomorrow.
Madam Chair, as I was leafing through my booklet, I saw a very strong indicator that is more than symbolic of the department's new openness, fresh and collaborative approach, and that is all of the directors and their assistants' office and cell phone numbers. I'd like to read those to all those in TV. Thank you very much.
I want to join him in that. I mean, is fantastic to have a social service agency where people work so hard every day on the ground with human suffering, and then for us to have access to you. And I'm sure people will not abuse this, but the fact that you did it is quite heartwarming, and also is on that area, in that area that I call excellence. Thank you very much.